As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Well, the second quarter earnings season winding down. We expect Disney to report after the bell. Snap reporting on the 10th of August, 2 days from now. Here with us to talk about the media landscape in more is Sir Martin Sorrell, the CEO of WPP here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. Great to have you.
Good morning.
With us here in New York.
Good morning.
Let's look ahead here to these Snap results. I know that WPP has upped its spend in Snap. What do a lot of people not get about this platform, about this company? We saw the excitement leading up to the IPO and maybe some disappointment that followed in the weeks and months to follow. What do you see in Snap that others don't?
Well, I don't know whether we see anything.
I mean, enough to put somebody behind it, yes.
But if you compare the levels of spending that we're talking about are at the low end in relation to the two...
200 million.
The two giants. It was 100 million last year, just under, which was about a quarter of their revenues for 2016. This year, we're projecting at about double that, about 200 million. But that pales into insignificance when you compare it to Google, where we were spending last year just under 5 billion.
Wow.
And with Facebook, just under 2 billion this year. Both of those will be up significantly on where they were last year. So you are talking about relatively minor spending in relation to the two big digital giants. Now, giants, Google and Facebook, control about or influence about, 75% of mm-hmm. digital spending. And a lot of people argue the increment each year of the growth each year, they take even more than 100% because others drop by the wayside. So it goes. But they are very significant and growing in significance. So we just went to Google Camp in Sicily. And
there is such a thing?
There is a Google Camp. it tries to mimic, I think, Allen and Company's
very good.
Sun Valley. Keep the press out of that one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah.
But that basically, you know, just demonstrates yet again in that environment how strong Google's offer is. There are challenges coming down the pike. I mean, there is a third force. Some people, when you said, what do we see in Snap that others don't see, it's not quite that. But people are looking for a third force because of the dominance of the two big bananas. Facebook and Google are very significant. So people are always looking for a third force. It could be Snap, which Facebook has imitated very successfully, and Snap is imitating Facebook, and Google is actually imitating Facebook as well. So we're getting a lot of imitation, but we need a third force. It could be Oath, which is the new Verizon
AOL successor,
combination with Tim Armstrong. It could be the company we've invested in, AppNexus. It could be Snap, but it could well be Amazon. Amazon are challenging on the search side. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that 55% of product searches in America are initiated by Amazon. The voice-activated devices, whether it be Alexa or Echo, and Alibaba today, I think, is actually launching Genie, which is its voice-activated device. In China, JD.com have had the wonderfully named Ding Dong, a voice-activated device on offer for 2 years. But that also will influence search. And then, of course, Amazon in advertising as well, because Amazon is building a strong advertising platform.
You mentioned Sun Valley. We last spoke there, and you were headed to China for 2 weeks, and you're bringing up Ding Dong and Genie and all of that.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that trip about the media landscape there, how it's changing and where you might see
well, if
opportunity
you want, if you
in
wanted
China.
To see a laboratory for what the world might look like here, or increasingly is looking like here, you go to China. I mean, people, I think, forget. They look at the UK economy and say, that's one of the strongest, if not the strongest, e-commerce, internet-based economy.
And you're not just going to Beijing and Shanghai, you're going
We went on that trip. We started, actually went to Taiwan. I had been to Taiwan for some time. We went to Taipei, and then we went to Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Shanghai, Hangzhou, and then Beijing. So pretty much the coastal plain. We didn't go into Chengdu and Chongqing, which we did 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I mean, the thing that hits you right in the eye is the technology. The Shenzhen campus of Huawei has 50,000 people on it. When I last visited it, I think Huawei's revenues were about 35 billion, it's now 75 billion. And of course, they don't have access to the US market, which is about 22% of the market. So their penetration and growth is quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. The Alibaba campus also, which I think has 15,000 people on it at Hangzhou, is another good example of these technology firms. So one lesson you learn is that we tend to think that the Chinese steal technology or copy or have done, but we said the same thing about the Japanese. Right. We said the same thing about the South Koreans. We said the same thing about the Hong Kong Chinese. But if they were stealing, which may have been the case, they're certainly not now. They're creating now, and they're becoming a major technological force. The other thing you see is the rise of the local companies. Mm. So the multinationals, the Western multinationals, tend to think that their competition are other Western multinationals. Right. They're not. It's the local companies that are increasingly penetrating not just the Chinese markets, but increasingly the ASEAN markets too.
Quick business question. I want to rip up the script. Tell me about automatic data processing. How does a board respond to Mr. Ackman of a big, fancy, prestigious company, whether it's ADP or WPP, Alphabet Soup today?
Well, you certainly don't ignore them. Yeah. I think you have to, my own view would be you have to engage with them, you have to talk to them, you have to listen to them, you have to to consider the ideas that they have, and then come to your views, and the board has to come to views about whether they respond or they don't. But I think you ignore these people at your peril.
Yeah. I want to rip up the script, Sir Martin. You have been most accommodative and supportive of the Royal Foundation of the Duke and Justice Duchess and the charitable efforts of the Crown. I at gunpoint over the last number of days have had to binge watch The Crown on Netflix. What's the future of the royal family in your United Kingdom?
Good idea. You have ripped up the script. The last thing I thought at 7 o'clock in the morning in New York with Tom Keane and on Bloomberg.
A moving photo on the cover of the New York Times of Prince Philip, age 96, retiring. Yes.
The Queen. New generations, isn't that? We're going to have the next.
How will they be received by the people of the United Kingdom, the new generation?
I think well, actually. I think they've adapted or in the process of adapting extremely effectively. I think that's been one of the cardinal attributes of the royal family is that they have over the years been very sensitive and aware of public opinion and changes and shifts in public opinion and have adapted effectively as a result.
What's the shift going on right now?
Well, you're seeing. We have to see what happens over time in terms of what happens in terms of succession with Prince Charles, and then beyond Prince Charles. But I think actually they have adapted extremely effectively over the years. I mean, the Crown is a wonderful series. It's a wonderful piece of binge viewing. And of course, what's great?
I looked for you in there.
I wasn't around. I was around at the death of Churchill, but I was a very young vintage then, Tom. Yeah. But the wonderful thing about The Crown, of course, it can go on forever, can't it? Really? I mean, I think we finished the first series one just after the death of Churchill and Suez and Anthony Eden, and we've got a long way to go yet, Tom. I mean, this is going to run and probably run through all these generations.
I'm going to miss Claire Foy, though.
Google Camp, did you meet Dragon Lady? Did you meet Dragon Lady at Google Camp?
No, I did reported not.
She was there as well. Emily, is that her name, David?
We can't.
You can't divulge who
we can't divulge. You can't off the record.
Sir Martin can't divulge which dragon he wrote on at Google Camp. Sir Martin Sorrell, thank you so much for too brief a visit today on important matters like China and ADP
and the royal family
and the crown.
That was a left field. That's what you are.
But it's the queen is what, 96?
Is that right?
91? 91, I think she's younger.
It's a pop quiz.
Younger than Prince Philip is, as well. Leon Cooperman of Goldman Sachs and Omega. His philanthropies as well, Columbia Business School and St. Barnabas Medical Center out in New Jersey. And we must speak, of course, of another New Jersey institution, Automatic Data Processing. We'll get to that in a moment. Leon, congratulations, all of our listeners, particularly some of us that have not shared the pixie dust of you and your bride, Toby, want to know how you get to 53 years of marriage. You two met at Hunter College. I think this is before you had a gazillion dollars. What has been the magic for Leon and Toby as you celebrate your 53rd anniversary?
Well, thank you for your congratulations. I just get up every morning and I apologize for what I might have done wrong in the coming day.
Well, that would be
preemptive apology. I like
congratulations on that. If we're lucky, we'll survive 53 years of Bill Ackman. I believe you chiseled a Cooperman letter to Mr. Ackman on his attention to automatic data processing, Frank Lautenberg's company. What is in that letter, Mr. Cooperman?
No, I want to make something very clear, a couple of disclosures. I have no dog in this fight. I was a director for almost 20 years. I left the board about 5 years ago. I gave all my stock away to charity when I left the board. That was a big mistake because the stock has almost tripled since I left the board. I should have given cash and kept the stock. And I know and I respect Bill Ackman. Notwithstanding my respect for him, I consider his behavior in this instance, the best described as foolish, inappropriate, and irresponsible. And I want to make sure I'm not addressing the merits of what he's going to say next Thursday at 9 o'clock in the morning. I gather he's going to have this big deal.
What's he doing wrong?
What he's doing wrong is the company deserves more respect. Apparently, as I understand it, he has spent 6 months studying the company. With about 8 days left before the window in the nominating committee closed, he went to the company very late in the process and asked them to delay the closing of the window, which is an inappropriate request. He owns 0.4% of the company in terms of actual stock. The rest is all derivative securities. He should have either planned to go to the company well before the window closed, or he should be patient and wait the year. This company has basically done a phenomenal job to investors. I said this yesterday in another program. You know, Ben Graham and the Intelligent Investor hypothesized that, you know, analysts evaluate management twice in their decision-making process, once through the numbers and once through face-to-face. The numbers are unbelievable at ADP. That doesn't say anything about the future. It all says about the past. What are the numbers? This company went public in 1961 with a de minimis value. I think they sold 100,000 shares at $3 to the public, and I think there have been three or four splits since then. Today, they have a market cap of $50 billion. They employ 58,000 people.
Right.
They have over 700,000 clients.
Within this,
add to that,
Leon, I think this is important. The issue here is what's the delta that can he make on this? If everyone agrees, including a street off the Bloomberg terminal, there are three buys, 16 holds. Mm-hmm. ADP seems to be fully valued within a broad spectrum, 29 times trailing earnings. What more do you see that he can gain? Where's his delta or his alpha, his gain on a fully priced blue chip?
That's a different question. Like I said, I'm addressing myself to his deportment. I'm not addressing myself to his argument. I know what his argument is. He says that paychex margins are twice that of ADP, and if properly run, they should double their margins, which is a fallacious argument because they're in a different business than paychex. I'll read you something. I got an email from an undisclosed retired executive from the company. It says, I just read your comments on the above on Bloomberg and agree with you completely. In addition, I think the rationale for the activists like Bill Ackman who have been looking at ADP is based on a margin comparison with paychecks, among others. What they do not seem to understand is that ADP is a very different business from paychecks and other like domestic competitors, and that when you are in the national accounts arena, international payroll, human resources, and have a large PEO, margins are reduced by workers' compensation insurance.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So it's a different kind of business. So the point I'm going to make is they generate 40% return on equity. The S&P is maybe 15 or 16% these days. They do it with a debt-free balance sheet. The typical corporation today has 35% debt
right.
to capital. So their return on capital is very high.
Well,
they've had a 17% compound rate of return, rate of growth, over a 50, 60-year period. This is a record unparalleled in American industry. So this guy comes from the outside and he says, I could run your business better than you could run your business. This is what you got to do. I'm saying the ADP has always done everything for the shareholder. They spun out their auto dealer services business knowing full well when they did that they would lose their AAA credit rating because the rating agencies look at one of the elements of giving a credit
right.
rating
okay.
is size. They gave up size because they thought it was the right,
right.
thing for the shareholder.
Joining us worldwide. Let me cut in here, Leon, and keep us going with David Gura. Joining us worldwide, Leon Cooperman of Omega, as we talk automatic data. David, I want to point out, on a revenue basis, ADP is four times the size of paychex, $12-plus billion versus a $3 billion compare and contrast. David Gura?
Yeah, Mr. Cooperman, let me just ask you what this approach, the way that Mr. Ackman appears to be doing this, says about the state of activist investing today. Can you draw any conclusions about where activism is in light of what we've seen?
Look, activism is a very complex situation. It's a little different question, but essentially I think that the market is reasonably fully valued. Returns are hard to come by, and there are select hedge funds that decided the way to generate returns is going the activist approach. And I would say that I've seen the best of activism and the worst of activism from the same firms. And I look at activism as a individual situation one at a time. And what I'm saying here is I think, and Tom gave a lot of statistics, I don't know what he's going to gain at 29 times earnings, 40% return equity, great long-term record. If he's right that they could double their margins, which I doubt, by the way, because they're in a different business. They're in a high-touch business. It's a little bit like a brokerage firm. A brokerage firm says, I don't want to do any business with you at 1 cent a share, but I'll do all your business at 10 cents a share. Okay, you can't cherry-pick. If you're serving large national clients, you basically have to provide them a full suite of services. And some services have higher margins than other services. And I think Bill is missing that. But again, my point is very simple. Do you make the kind of hoopla he's making, or do you sit down with the company in a quiet, closed manner? And so I think he's got some personal motivations that I question. The company deserves more respect for how they've conducted their affairs. This is a record second to none in American industry.
And Mr. Rodriguez, Carlos Rodriguez has invited Mr. Ackman to sit down and do, as you say, to talk to them about this in a quiet room. Why did you walk us through your calculus here? Why did you decide to write this email? Why did you decide to go public about the email? What prompted you to speak out about this?
Well, I know the people at ADP well. I know their culture, and I believe always saying what I think is appropriate. And I think it's inappropriate that, look, he's going to put them into a costly proxy contest. He's going to divert management attention from running the business. We're very in a competitive world. They have to focus on their business. It's unnecessary. You know, also, it's interesting. He has three people he nominated to the board, one of which, I don't know any of the people other than Bill, one of which is 71 years of age. If he studies the company's bylaws, they have a mandatory retirement age of 72. So this is going to be a director. The time this proxy fight is over, this guy won't even be qualified to serve on the board. You know, it's just unnecessary. It's unnecessary, and it serves a different purpose.
Leon, so, automatic data processing, back to Mr. Lautenberg, Senator Lautenberg, has been not a model.
Actually, in all fairness, Henry Taub was the founder.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I stand correct. Thank you, sir. They have always been a charming, ginormous success with a mom-and-pop tone. They've always had a locality of New Jersey that's been, to many of us, charming. Has that been their trap? Does Bill Ackman look at them as a bunch of hayseeds from New Jersey?
Look, I'm gone for 5 years. I doubt that he looks at them that way. They have, you know, major national accounts. They issue one out of every six non-governmental payroll checks to the country. So they have big clients, they have small clients, they have national accounts, they have local accounts, you know. And again, it's this is the problem in how Bill is looking at the margins. He's not allowing for the fact that they're in a different business than paychecks. But if you look at the rate of return on the stock, again, I'm not knocking paychecks. They've outdistanced paychecks over 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years in terms of return in the stock market.
Liam,
what is he looking for? What is he expecting these guys to do?
We're going to find out here.
Fabulous job.
Find out here in a few days. Leon Cooperman, you've never seen All Quiet on the Hedge Fund, All Quiet on the Equity Market front. Volatility now is low, low, low. Can Leon Cooperman do business as usual in the milieu of the quiet of this August?
Well, you just have to be patient, that's all. You have to be patient. It's as simple as that. I think that everybody has been busy moving out on the risk curve because the Fed has conducted monetary policy in a fashion that's forcing people to take on more risk. If you were a buyer of T-bills because you were risk-averse, somewhere along the way you concluded, I can't survive on zero, so I'm going to buy T-bonds and take duration risk. The buyer of T-bonds says, well, I'm not impressed, I can't survive on 2%, I'm going to take industrial credit risk. So you move to industrial credits. The industrial credit buyer said, well, 4% doesn't impress me, I'm going to go for high yield. And the high yield buyer says, well, I'll go to the opaque structured credit market. And then the structured credit guy says, well, I'll put 25% of my fund in equities. So everybody's moved out in the risk curve. And when the circumstances change, there is risk in the market. But everybody's pointing to that risk. Yeah. I know you have Jeff Gundlach, who's a terrific, thoughtful person. On your program, I think today, I heard him advertised. But, when circumstances change, the market will change.
Right.
But as I've said repeatedly, bear markets don't materialize out of immaculate conception. They come about for fundamental reasons.
Right.
And I've identified four reasons that you generally have a bear market. Reason number one, and most prevalent, is the stock market smells an oncoming recession and declines in anticipation of recession. The economic numbers don't read recession. In the United States, they read slow growth, 2.5%, with some acceleration. Europe is doing better. China's growing 6.5%. Japan's doing modestly better. So the global economy is growing north of 3%. Recession doesn't seem to be the forecast. Okay. Number two is the Fed turns hostile and takes the punch out of the punch bowl. We have a Fed moving extraordinarily slowly. Okay. And they don't present valuation levels presently are low relative to interest rates. But I happen to agree with Mr. Greenspan, who says that, bonds are a bubble, but I believe he felt that way for 3 or 4 years.
Right.
We've all been wrong on bonds. The third reason you have a significant correction is the market becomes euphoric and it's pricing very sloppy, and I love the comment that John Templeton coined, bull markets are born in pessimism, they grow in skepticism, they mature in optimism, and they die in euphoria. I see very little signs of euphoria. The individual is not heavily participating in the market, but the market is not undervalued.
You mentioned Sir John. Well, tell me the fourth thing, please, quickly.
Well, the fourth reason you have a bear market is some significant geopolitical event catches the market by surprise, whether it's a Cuban Missile Crisis, whether it's President Kennedy taking on the steel industry.
Right.
Something shocks the market. There's a lot of things to worry about, North Korea, Ukraine, Russia, whatever. Go ahead.
But, Leon, to Sir John Templeton, and I guess this goes back to Mr. Weinberg and your Goldman Sachs, are you in the mood now the trees are growing to the sky?
No, interest rates are not going to the sky.
Okay.
Number one, we live in a global economy, and we're tied into European interest rates as well as our own interest rates. I think what I would say is that we're returning to normalcy. We're slowly on the path to normalcy. We've been in a very abnormal environment. You know, a year ago, if you lived in Denmark, you would get a check every month because you took out a house mortgage. They would give you a negative interest rate. 6 months ago, Switzerland borrowed 50-year money at a negative interest rate. That doesn't make any sense. And the Bund is 47 basis points in Germany. Okay, in the United States, historically, a 10-year government bond is yielded in line with nominal GDP. Nominal GDP being the summation of inflation and real growth. The world I see is, as I said, we're returning to normal. So let's say normal is the following. Half the 1% growth in the labor force, 1.5% growth in productivity, that's 2% real. And 2% for inflation is 4% nominal. In a 4% nominal world, I think the Fed funds rate ought to be 2% and the 10-year government ought to be 4%. Okay. It may take a year to get to 2% of Fed funds. It may take 2 to 3 years to get to 4%. In that world, the multiple in the market would be 17 times.
Okay.
If I take 17 times the earnings estimate, the market's in a zone of fair value.
Leon, that's too much math for Tuesday. We do that much math on Wednesday. One final question, Leon Cooperman. Our Alex Steele did, I thought, an elegiac and wonderful interview with Mr. Blankfein, again, of your Goldman Sachs. Tell me about trading desks at firms. Did Goldman Sachs, in this stumble of one quarter, was it just about making a lousy Trump trade?
I'm not close enough anymore. I retired 26 years ago. As I can tell you, they're a superb firm. They're extremely well managed. The press is, you know, it's got to find something to say at all times. I look at 160 or 70 year record as more indicative than one quarter. So don't sell Goldman Sachs short. They're
David
smart
Gura,
people. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, David, let me get a last in word here, in here. He's got to go to breakfast with Toby.
I know.
Mr.
Cooper, have you gotten a reply from Mr. Ackman? And what are you going to be listening for on the 17th of August when this web presentation gets underway with Bill Ackman?
Bill called me twice. Again, I think he's kind of missing my point, and I want to make sure you understand my point. I'm not addressing – in fact, I would say a little bit the following. If he has such an alarming report to make that this company's been mismanaged, what the hell is he going long a 28 multiple stock? You know, if he exposes that they've done a terrible job and they're vulnerable, that their business is weaker than everybody thinks. Everybody thinks they're wonderful, right? That's what 29 times earnings is all about. I think they're wonderful. I'm not making a forecast about the future. I'm saying let's have civility. You know, this company has been always run for the shareholders. They have an open-door policy. They would have received Bill. Bill waited too close to the closing of the nomination window, basically, and that was his responsibility. Now, to me, maybe I'm a wuss, but to me, this company's performance would merit his doing nothing for a year, spending the next 12 months or some part of the next 12 months convincing the company that he's got something relevant. He's a thoughtful guy. He's a hardworking guy. Okay, he has a personality streak that's different than some.
Two phone calls. Was the conversation civil?
He respects me. I respect him. And, you know, he says, don't say anything until you listen to my presentation. He says, the presentation is not the point. You know, let me just say this. He's going to get pissed off at me, if I can say that on TV, radio, whatever. But basically, I give a lot of lectures to young kids at colleges in terms of guidance. And I tell them, no matter how rich you are, the one luxury you cannot afford is arrogance.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that.
One quick question. Are you taking Toby to the grill tonight? It's a new hot spot.
I'm taking Toby to the Berkshires to go to Tanglewood. Don't worry. Toby takes care of himself. I toe the line. That's how you survive for 53 years.
I would think so. Mr. Cooperman, thank you so much. Leon Cooperman of Omega with us, particularly on automatic data processing, and Mr. Ackman. You learn anything there, David?
I know that Schubert is on the agenda tonight at Tanglewood. Schubert's...
Summer journey. Listen to you.
So enjoy the Schubert, Mr. Cooperman.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
One of my sources in August, folks, you know, it's sort of like summer, and David's worried about, you know, are the tomatoes looking good and is the kale good? I like pick a research topic. And my research topic this summer, forced on me by the brilliant work of Olivier Blanchard on hysteresis and some great IMF work on labor share, is on just that. How much is labor as a percentage of corporate income? And it is an ugly picture. That's going to be one of our big themes over the next hour. Jared Bernstein, again, senior fellow. I love this. CBPP. Acronyms in Washington, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He is the liberal economist conservatives must read, as they do often, to get very good analysis on some of these trends. Jared, to push against CBPP, the Economic Policy Institute, I guess it's a better America. For how much of America is it a better America?
Well, for a long time, the wage and income gains for the bottom two-thirds of the income scale have been quite weak, with one notable exception, which would be the second half of the 1990s. So, for example, if you look at the average earnings of the bottom, say, 75% or so, you know, they're not that different now than they were in, say, 2000, and they're not that different in 2000 than they were in 1980. So they've had some bips and bops up and down. Most of the growth has accrued to those in the top 10%, and among the top 10, it's been the top 1, and among the top 1, it's been the top 0.1. So there's been increasing concentration where the kind of the glue that used to kind of attach economic growth to median and low-paid workers, that's kind of been missing for the past few decades.
David Leonard has a fabulous graphic display out in the New York Times. I'll get it out on Twitter, folks, of the change of our lifespan in labor, of the haves and the have-nots. This is off of important words from, among others, Mr. Piketty. Jared Bernstein, is it two Americas or is it almost three Americas, where there's a middle class that's caught between the two?
Geez, I don't know. I don't know quite what the right number is, because you might say there were sort of two Americas in the sense that most of the growth was accruing to the top, and then everyone else was kind of struggling along with stagnating wages and incomes. But then you have these political divides that appear with the election of Donald Trump, and there you have a kind of interpretation that says, you know, kind of one group of Americans is taking from another, or other countries are eating our lunch. Once you have this kind of maldistribution of growth, demagogues often surface and point to somebody, some group that they vilify and say they're the bad guy. And of course, economics and life and distribution of growth is much more complicated than that.
Jared, I pulled up a chart yesterday on Bloomberg Television looking at skilled workers, workers who had gone to college versus those who had just finished high school. And there's a widening divide there. Those with a high school education are actually seeing an uptick in participation, and they're seeing a downtrend here in those who have taken some college or have an associate's degree. When you look at the most recent report from the Labor Department, what did you learn about who's getting jobs in this economy, particularly when it comes to education?
Well, there you actually see, as you suggested, it's not just the college-educated who are picking up the pace. In fact, if you look at, as you said, if you look at folks with less than a college education, their participation rates have been growing. The problem is that they've been on a long-term downward trend. So you sort of have to separate the structure from the cycle. If you look at guys, prime-age guys, 25 to 54, without a college degree, they're the ones who, over the long term, have really lost ground. But you bring up a really important point that's overlooked in this conversation. People write off those guys, saying there's no room for them in the economy. Well, even over this business cycle, this expansion, which has been, you know, kind of plodding for sure, their participation rates, especially their employment rates, have actually gone up considerably. They've maybe erased two-thirds of what they've lost. And so it does say that while there's a structural problem, no doubt about it, there's also a cyclical response. These guys will come back to work if the labor demand is there. At least many of them will.
Pivot here to ask you about the conversation around tax reform in Washington. Of course, the House and Senate on recess, now the president up in Bedminster, but there are, I'm sure, staffers toiling away in the bowels of the buildings on Capitol Hill. Let me read you the headline from a piece on the Bloomberg this morning. Republicans discuss a mix of temporary, permanent tax changes, looking now at sort of the contours of what's tax reform and what are tax cuts. Do you think we're headed now toward cuts versus reform?
I would strongly assert that we are, and I think the headline that you just read suggests it. Basically, the way to look at this is if you're talking about a kind of tax program like George Bush II put into place, this is a program that, to meet budget rules, had to sunset in 10 years. So that's not permanent. And when you start hearing stuff about sunsets, you know that they're trying to meet budget rules that require that they don't increase the deficit outside the 10-year window. That's going to be a tax cut, not tax reform. And I think that's problematic, both in the sense that we were just talking about, that exacerbates the inequality because most of these cuts go to the wealthy, and also because we're going to lose trillions of revenue, which the Treasury really needs to meet many of the challenges we face.
Jared, within that labor dynamic, to speak for conservatives listening to this program and Republicans and supporters of Mr. Trump, and this goes, folks, to a terrific op-ed by Catherine Rempel in the Washington Post today. Do we advantage the poor? Do we advantage those that support the left by taking it from the wealthy and from the haves? Or can we do it by building GDP growth?
Well, I actually have been a big advocate of the latter, although I haven't put it in the context of building GDP growth, because I think that gets thrown around way too kind of carelessly. People say, oh, I can get to 3% or 4% without any real cogent plan to boost productivity or labor supply. But just like my last comments to David, what I think is one of the great and under-tapped solutions to the inequality problem is a full employment labor market. Now, you might say, don't we have that already? Well, we're certainly moving in that direction. And as we've moved in that direction, you've seen some pressure on wage growth. Nominal wages have gone up from around 2 to 2.5% or so. I don't like the way they're kind of sitting there. I think they ought to be accelerating. But we've had full employment really only 30% of the time since 1980. Before that, we had it 70% of the time. That's using CBO's measures of the full employment rate. So we live in an economy where we're full employment. By the way, that's full employment is the assumption in every economics textbook you read. That assumption's wrong. We live in an economy where, you know, more than two-thirds of the time we've got slack labor markets. So I would think that liberals and conservatives would want to do something about that.
What happens when we get to full employment, when there's universal acknowledgement that we're there? What changes policy-wise, Jared?
Well, it's a great question, and one of the things that definitely happens is you draw more people into the job market and there's more pressure on wages. Basically, middle and low-wage workers have the bargaining clout, the bargaining power that they lack in slack labor markets to put pressure on the wage bill.
Employers, do you see any indication of that?
I see some indication of it. I definitely do. I see a little bit less than I might have expected. But here's the other thing. This is completely theoretical. Well, not completely. This is largely theoretical. There's some evidence. So what's one of our biggest macroeconomic problems? It's slow productivity growth, right?
Yeah.
Well, I have something I've written about called the full employment, FEPM, the full employment productivity multiplier. I believe at full employment, I've got some evidence, but not a ton. At full employment, you enforce a kind of discipline among firms where, in order to maintain their profit margins, they have to establish a level of efficiency. They have to squeeze out some of their inefficient production practices in order to maintain their profit margins in the face of pressure on earnings.
Let's do this. Let's come back and talk to Jared Bernstein about his alphabet soup, FEPM. Jared Bernstein with CBPP. Lots to talk about. Jared Bernstein with us. He is someone who's done smart and consistent work across all of our politics in support of Democrat politics within Economic Policy Institute and now the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, and of course provided perspective and counsel to the former Vice President, Mr. Biden. Jared, a political question, but you are attuned to this. Can the progressive elite Democrats, the non-Joe Bidens, can they find the Joe Biden Democrats in the next two go-arounds of 18 and 20? Is it feasible they can find a Democrat Party constituency crying out for representation?
Well, it's definitely feasible, and it's also something that they're explicitly trying to do. I don't know. You guys have probably reported on their better deal ideas. Yeah. Many of those ideas try to push back on some of the trends behind the problems we were just talking about. You mentioned, interestingly, that you're looking at this decline in the labor share of national income. Well, there's a very nice paper out recently by a bunch of top economists, David Auder, Larry Katz, others.
Yeah.
And it finds that the concentration among firms, kind of almost a monopolistic concentration of firms in areas like transportation, airlines, retail, banking, contributes to this decline in labor share. So in this Better Deal platform is a kind of trust buster function to go after some of this excessive concentration. Again, an old idea that dates back to Adam Smith and really isn't necessarily liberal or conservative at all. It's just, you know, smart economics.
Jared, I've talked with Tim Phillips of Americans for Prosperity, talked with the head of Heritage Action a couple of days ago about their plans for moving ahead here with tax reform, the argument that they plan to make. Are you seeing progressive groups coming together in the same way? I noted in my conversation with Mr. Phillips a keener interest in talking about tax reform than the group had talking about health care. Are we seeing a similar response from progressive groups?
Well, look, I'm very much into this distinction between tax reform and tax cuts. The former, tax reform, means at least revenue neutral, broaden the base, lower the rates, close a bunch of loopholes, that kind of thing. And there's some talk of that. But what I think we're going to end up with is just the same old sort of tax cuts that increase the deficit and have some phony budgeting in there to make that deficit problem go away. So, you know, my concern is that the groups that are out there that are fighting for a tax code that sounds good to middle class people, you know, they're really just trying to sell them the same old snake oil.
What did you make of the one page statement that we got before the House and the Senate went on recess? This was a statement signed by Republican leadership in the House, the Senate, and the administration, the so-called Big Six. It was a page long. Squarely saying the border-adjusted tax was off the table, but what could you read between the lines there that it took so long to come up with that one piece of paper?
Well, it's a remarkable thing. I mean, before that, a few weeks ago, Orrin Hatch, who's on that group of six and one of the big tax writers in the Congress right now, sent out a note basically saying, hey, if anybody has any good ideas for tax reform, let me know. So this is their brand, and they got almost nothing. I mean, basically, all they know is they want to cut taxes, and they're just kind of lurching around figuring out how to do it. And it has surprised me. On health care, it didn't surprise me at all because they're not really known for thinking that much about health care policy.
Jared, are we overtaxed? When you sum up the taxes that each individual listener has, not this gimmick of look at the federal, look at the state separate, sum up the eight taxes we have every year. Are we overtaxed, those that are working and paying their fair share?
It's not that simple a question to answer. Certainly relative to other countries, this is contrary to something Trump always says, we're undertaxed probably by about 10 percentage points of GDP. That is, we collect something like 30% of GDP in all forms
all
of taxes.
All taxes in. Everything
all
in.
All taxes all in, and other countries are, you know, closer to 40%. So, you know, in that sense, but, you know, we're not Denmark, we're not Sweden, so I don't know that that's that responsive an answer to your question. I think the answer to that question is, you know, first of all, the tax code is way too complex. I don't know if we're overtaxed, but we're certainly too complexified in our taxes. But secondly, I think the answer to that question is, how do you feel about the public goods that you're getting? I mean, nobody wants to pay higher taxes, but look around and ask yourselves, are our public schools where we want them to be? Are our roads and our water systems, are our bridges wanting to be? Are we financing our retirement security through our social insurance programs adequately? Are we ready for geopolitical risk, for climate risk? And to me, the answer to that question, especially if you look at our demographics, is no.
Yeah.
So that's where I take
that. Yeah. I got 12 seconds. Is Vice President Biden going to run?
He might.
Yeah.
Oh, what
well
a question.
Well
what a, the, I believe an economist just answered the question. Jared Bernstein, thank you that you might come on with us. Great. You are correct about
I'm
that.
I'm setting 100%, the headline now.
Yeah, please. Biden might run. Bernstein. Jared, thank you so much. The Center on Budget and Policy. He's slick. He's like, he's been in Washington too long.
Well, as you say, you know, invaluable to listen to, no matter what your political stripes.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.